Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's programme, we'll be meeting Arling Kagge, the Norwegian adventurer, climber and walker, is also a celebrated author. His latest book celebrates putting one foot in front of the other.
We'll also be hearing from Tamara Rojo, the artistic director of the English National Ballet. We'll be discussing their current production at Sadler's Wells Theatre.
And we'll be looking at what possesses athletes to compete in the upcoming Paris-Roubaix cycling race, much of which takes place over miles of bone-rattling cobbled paving.
Plus, Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be keeping the ride smooth with some of next week's news today. And we'll enjoy some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Aug, a great pleasure to be here in the Monocle Weekly chairs with you again this Sunday lunchtime. I know you're a reasonably keen cyclist. Would you ever tackle the Paris-Roubaix? Cobbles might do you a bit of an injustice.
I was going to ask you the very same question. I don't think that it sounds worth it to me.
That's,
to you?
What a man of ambition you are. So you would never tackle one of those étape, you know, where you do the whole Tour de France stage, one of the mountain stages, like ahead of the main race. You wouldn't tackle something like that? I don't really see you as an endurance athlete kind of guy.
My attachment to cycling is purely pragmatically led. It's nice to get to work. I don't like going on the tube in London, England. So I steer clear. I cycle cheaper, healthier, apart from the black lung I'm acquiring from the soot of the buses.
Well, it's interesting. Not only that sort of achievement, endurance feat, but we're going to be talking to Arling Kagge. I'm really excited to meet him. A man who, let's not forget, has trekked solo to both poles and scaled Everest. I mean, I don't know how many people there are on that list at the centre of that Venn diagram. I'm guessing it might just be Arling Kagge.
Well, normally when you think of those guys as well, they're all kind of slightly grizzly ex-army men, aren't they? Sort of scar over the eye, working out some demons as they trek into the great white nothing. But Arling sounds like a completely reasonable chap. Just had a career in... He was a lawyer, wasn't he? And then he got into walking.
I'm really looking forward to meeting him. Mm. But as I guess his walking philosophy and Buddhist tenets would have it, even those long journeys, Aug, begin with a single step. So without further ado, best foot forward. Let's introduce Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something. Faye, where shall we start?
I think, you know, from the 9th of April, I'm heading to Milan, and Salone del Mobili, the most important furniture fair in the world, is going to be my first time there. But what I am understanding, it's, you know, all the top editors are going to be there, you know, designers, not something only related to furniture. And that's why I think, right, Tom, we're going to have quite a few shows from there as well.
Very busy, all across the Monocle 24 schedule. People need to listen out. But yeah, there'll be all sorts of dispatches and programming and live occurrences. People, if you're, particularly if someone's hearing this and maybe they're heading to Milan this week, come and visit us. Via Tortona, we've got our little setup there. Grab a coffee, meet Fernando face to face.
Exactly.
Very exciting stuff.
What should I wear? I should ask those people. So what's the dress code in the design?
Shorts.
Well, I saw the temperatures. I think it's going to be 19 degrees on average. Perhaps a bit rainy though. I wonder.
Well, a short can still work in that. Less material to get rained on.
And guys, there's something to be said about Milan as well. I think even our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, is a big fan of the city, which has been going through some sort of kind of renaissance. There's a lot of kind of new projects in town. So, you know, they always hosted this furniture fair, but I think specifically this year, you know, they have a step on their foot.
That's exciting.
A spring in their step. We'll be, you and I will be arriving sometime tomorrow. But yeah, do watch this space. Plenty of exciting stuff happening in Milan. Where else is in your crosshairs this week, Fernando?
If you're interested on a very interesting election, though, we have on the 9th of April elections in Israel. And this one's going to be very important for Netanyahu. I mean, if he does win again, he might be the longest serving prime minister in the country as well. But this time, I think he does have a few good challengers. So, for example, we have Benny Gantz. He used to work for the Israeli Defense Forces. And again, he can also play that security card that Benjamin Netanyahu is so good at it. And that's why perhaps he wins so many elections. And even though, I mean, his image abroad perhaps is not as good as in Israel itself, he still has a chance to win. So it's going to be a very interesting one to look out.
Where does he stand with the threat of indictment? I thought that that was something that was hanging like the sword of Damocles over his head.
He's under a huge amount of pressure. But it is that interesting point. You know, we've seen in markets all around the world, from the US to...
the Philippines.
Well, and wherever you go, look at Canada at the moment. It doesn't seem to necessarily derail election campaigns. I guess in Canada, the proof of that pudding will be in the eating, but... I wouldn't be surprised if he does set that record.
And in a weird way, those accusations against him, it can almost help in a way, because he says, look, I am the victim of, you know, of the elites attacking me for all those sort of scandals.
This is the Trump narrative, and we saw it with Bolsonaro, the same thing. They can easily seem to present their critics as part of this conspiracy against them, and that they're the voice of the working man. So it'll be a really interesting one to watch.
Some quite scary... nationalists also on the ballot, are there not? So we're kind of hoping Gantz, is he one of the more centrist candidates?
Yeah.
Relative to the...
more centrist than Netanyahu, for sure. And I think he's the main challenger. But, you know, I don't know how reliable are the polls there in Israel. So we should wait and
Fascinating.
See.
Fascinating.
Where next, Faye?
Well, a lighter story. On the 13th of April, on Saturday, especially, I mean, we're all from London, right? So I think I hope we'll be back from Milan, but it's the Record Store Day, which is something that started here in the United Kingdom quite successfully, actually. So a lot of kind of, you know, record shops around the country, they host special events. Are you a big fan? Do you still buy records?
I buy one every now and then when it's something I really like, and the rest of the time I just use streaming services. What about you? Ever been a vinyl junkie?
I've never really. I did always used to like to, I prefer to have my record collection on actual CDs, but I must confess these days I've kind of gone digital. I'm the kind of person maybe that this is speaking to. I should get out there and support my local record store.
And let's remember, the sales of vinyls, they're still on the rise. Of course, it's a small percentage compared to some of the streaming, but you know, it is big business. I don't think it's only a nostalgia trip as well. So yeah, if you're in the streets of London on Saturday, do go out, go to your favourite record shop and dance around the world.
This is the call for action for our weekly listeners. Wherever you are in the world, go and visit your local record store. Just get down there. Bit of footfall. Bricks and mortar. That's what we're all about.
Exactly.
There you go. Positive action called for on the Monocle Weekly. Fernando, thanks for being with us. This is the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be taking inspiration as we hear from Arling Kaga. Don't go away. Norwegian adventurer Arling Kaga has made journeys that few people on Earth can compare notes with. Not only has he scaled Everest, he's also been to the North Pole. He's reached the South Pole, solo, with a broken radio. And as an author and publisher, his philosophical reflections on all of these achievements have filled bestsellers, such as his recent book, Silence.
He has a new book coming out this April, Walking One Step at a Time, and he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome, Arling, to the Monocle Weekly. It's lovely to have you here with your great book, which we've been avidly flicking through. Bit of a departure in as much as it's kind of more circumspect. This is less about one trip and more about the trips that you've taken over your life. How have you kind of arrived at this point?
I think one of the biggest questions of our time is the questions, you know, my kids kept on asking me when they were small, and that was, why do we have to walk when it's faster to drive? I tried to answer them, but, you know, it was not easy. And then, you know, eventually all my friends were kind of also asking the same question. Why not speed up? And of course, everything in our society, from, you know, education, government and business, is all about speeding up. And then I felt it was important to sit down and spend a year and a half to write a thin book about walking, why walking is important.
And Arling, it's very arresting. It's kind of philosophical. It's meditative. It's very thoughtful. Of course, there's this sort of Buddhist notion of, you know, long journey starting with one step. And this is your thing of it's just one foot in front of the other. Is it a philosophical text? I mean, it's very thoughtful. Does it matter what we think it is?
It matters to me a lot that you like the book. I don't consider it to be philosophy myself. But as I said, Tom, I consider it to be philosophical about something which I find deeply important.
And tell us about how pervasive that importance is. Because as you said, you look around the world, everyone seems in such a hurry. To turn it around a bit, what do we risk losing if we forget it or we don't understand the importance of walking, of slowing down?
Ultimately, I think you risk losing yourself, in the sense that the higher speed you have, narrowing in the time and narrowing in the space around yourself and kind of forgetting yourself and start to live through the situation and through other people. While slowness is very good for getting to know yourself. It's very good for memory. When I walk here today, you see, you know, you could tell that some people are just speeding up and then you tend to forget. But if you slow down, then you tend to remember. And it's the same with creativity. You know, the reason great thinkers from Socrates to Steve Jobs have been walking all the time, obviously it's because they're thinking better. They become more creative. I wouldn't say we become the new Socrates or Steve Jobs by walking, but it's a good start.
It helps.
And yeah. Also, you know, with the language, we see that in English language, you say you move, you're being moved. Even in the language, you see that it's reflected.
It's something that struck me in the, you know, towards the start of the book, you talk about waking up and spending days where at every decision you take the easiest option, kind of functioning on autopilot. We've all had those days where suddenly, it's
bedtime. You have them very often, Org.
Well, you see me enjoying them as I stare into the middle distance. But, you know, to go back to this idea that we move too quickly, I can't remember if it was in Sapiens or in another of those pop philosophy books. We'd have to fact check it. I read this thing that said that for the average urban American, their average speed over the course of the year is something like 7 miles an hour in a car as a consequence of gridlock. It's not that much faster than walking, is it? And society does encourage, or we think we need to use these ways of getting around. We're in this rush, but really the rush is an illusion because we're still sitting there spending this. How do we start getting people to kind of burst out of this bubble?
I think that's a very good observation, that people tend to think they are in a hurry, they're in a rush, need to speed up. So jump in a car. But what's happening is that, you know, when you drive a car at high speed, you're not experiencing anything. The time narrows in. The feeling of a space of traveling is also narrowing in. If you walk the same distance, you maybe use 2 hours instead of a drive half an hour. And of course, mathematically, it holds up that it saved some time. But in real life, you didn't save any time because, you know, nothing happened while you were driving. I have to add that here in England, people probably live for around 80 years, which is about 30,000 days. Average Brit probably use around 3 hours every day on, you know, Instagram and Googling things, on watching the news, etc. And that adds up to 90,000 hours. They say that you need 10,000 hours to become an expert in something. And let's say, you know, all those 90 hours are not a waste, but let's say 80% are. So that leaves you with 72,000 hours. Then people say, no, I'm in a rush, I'm in a hurry. I need to do so and so because I'm so important. But, you know, it's not true. You have enough time if you use it in a good way.
In those 10,000 hours, just to pick you up on that, I guess you've spent them walking. So is this the kind of fruit of those 10,000 hours expertise?
Yeah, you know, I spend much more than 10,000 hours walking. I walk as a social thing. I walk with friends. I walk with my family. I walk with my girlfriend because it clears up your head. So the conversation's getting more interesting. And it's also nice and obviously, if you walk, you live longer than other people. Your lungs are working better. Your heart is beating, you know, more in a more rational way. You sleep better. You become more creative and you can work better. But of course, that's only half the truth. And what I want to write a book about was the other half.
Let me ask you about your own walking. It's impossible not to ask you about, I sort of just glibly mentioned in the intro, North Pole, South Pole, Everest. Like, these are common or garden things everyone does, which of course they're not. Particularly when you were on your own doing some of these really extraordinary achievements. How different is that walk than these social leisurely walks with your family? Are you someone who, do you get lonely if you're trekking to the pole? Your radio's broken. You're probably the loneliest person literally on the face of the planet. Did you feel lonely? You seem a very sanguine character. I don't know.
I didn't feel that lonely as a problem. No, I'm a very social person, but to be alone for a while, I think it's very healthy. And it's very good for you because you get more curious about other people. And also, I kind of get more respect for other people by being alone and try to, you know, grasp what's important in life. And then I have to add, as an explorer, that many of my peers today, when they're going to do a solo expedition, the North Pole, South Pole, or whatever, they bring a satellite phone because they think that's an advantage because you can talk to your boyfriend or girlfriend or whoever. I think that's a huge disadvantage. My experience is that if you call home from trips, in my case, if you call a girlfriend, you know, you talk, you said maybe you love each other, which is nice. And then eventually she will say, the washing machine broke down. And then, you know, it's over. You might as well just go home. So I think parts of the thing on an expedition is to for long walks is to be away. So that's also, I think, on short walks, but the difference between long walks and short walks, I think, you know, it has many similarities, but you have to remember also on short walks not to have anything in your hands, because as soon as you hold your phone in your hand, you will check that phone all the time. It's nothing wrong with it, but you're kind of missing this huge opportunity to have a richer life. Me too, sometimes I just feel too important not being connected and, you know, being unavailable. I have to be present for my colleagues, etc. But I think I'm wrong. I'm not that important. I think I can wait half an hour.
And what about where it's easiest to live by those principles? Do you find that in certain markets? And I guess a lot of people will say, oh, well, you know, the Northern Europeans are very good at having this kind of attitude. Did you find that a bit annoying? Because it's a bit of a lazy cliche, but like a lot of cliches, there's maybe an element of truth to it.
It's an element of truth for sure. But I think it's both silence and walking. It's more difficult than noise and sitting still. So you have to make choices throughout the whole day, and you have to choose if I'm going to go for the easiest option or the most difficult option. And then we tend to go to the easiest option at all times. And of course, that makes you much more unfree because it's predictable what you're going to choose. Also makes your life much more dull. So my recommendation, you know, for my kids is to quite often, you know, consider the hardest option, the most difficult option. And that doesn't matter if you live in France or if you live in Norway. I think it's the same. Obviously, if you live in southern Sudan, it's different because they have totally different challenges. But daily life for most people, I strongly recommend to try to go for the most difficult option, to do a walk, experience silence. And silence is very much about being present in your own life. If you don't do it, you live through other people all the time. I'm older than you guys, so I start to go to 60th, 70th, 80th birthdays, and what they all talk about is life being short.
You're actually not that much older than Tom.
Thanks very much.
You should freeze more.
I should point out, you know, our listeners might think, well, it's easy for Arlene to find this silence when you're kind of going out into the wilderness. Not everyone has the infrastructure or the means to go and walk to the South Pole or climb Everest. But actually, you know, you've also done these urban walks. You've explored the sewers around New York. You've walked the whole length of Sunset Strip in LA. How do those different environments change the reflections that you have, change the kind of quality of the silence that you experience?
Of course, you know, to go through the underground of New York City, sewage, train, subway, and water tunnel, it's a lot of noise. New York City is very much about making money. Making money makes noise. You can't wait for the silence to come to you. Somehow you have to invent your own silence and find your own silence. And then I'm thinking about the silence within, which is there all the time, just waiting for you to, you know, approach it. That's where you find, you know, really good meanings in life. So I found that silence also in New York and in LA. As I said, I'm a social guy. I like noise too, but, you know, we also need some silence in life. I think it's a bit scary to see how addictive telephones are. Look at friends, family, they're totally attached to those phones. I think that's one of the reasons people claim to be more lonely, sad and depressed in our society, because we lost touch with nature.
I mean, have you ever gone on one of these walks, these big explorations? Are you surprised by what you find? Like, I mean, again, so rare you get the opportunity. If you're standing on the top of Everest, was that how you imagined it? Was that a moment of calm? Was it very silent? Was it very noisy? Have you ever got somewhere and been like, this isn't at all what I was expecting?
I tell you, at the top of Everest, first, at least for me, I was super happy. But then soon after, I was thinking, how in hell should I get down again?
How quickly did that crop up? Within a couple of minutes?
I think it's a couple of minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And what about, because you keep talking about knowing yourself, have you had these moments? Is it like a revelation? Do the sort of clouds part metaphorically and you understand something more about how you are one person on this big planet in a moment like that? Or does it take a long time? Does it sort of sink in?
Yeah, it sinks in. Not on the top of Everest in particular, but, you know, on the way up or down. But it's very much about getting to know yourself. And I think many of those experiences you can't put words on. That's also another reason why I'm interested in silence, because I think, you know, many of the most important things in life will not be communicated by words. Yes, we are a part of all that we have met. And those expeditions are, you know, shaped me.
It's fantastic. You claimed it's not philosophical, but I feel I don't know, it seems fairly profound. I don't know, I guess that's the point of the exercise.
Yeah, I'm very happy for that because, you know, as I said, I spent a long time writing those few words. And I think, you know, in one way it's about, you know, finding your own South Pole.
Absolutely. Well, this is one great way to look for it. And as we mentioned, as you joined us in the studio, it's just the right size of a book. I know you said you shouldn't carry anything, but you could put it in your pocket and carry it when you go out walking because it's quite compact. It's perfect for a wander.
Yeah, I think, you know, people should spend one evening reading my book and then they should go for a walk.
It's a beautiful thing. It's walking one step at a time. Arling Hegge is the author. And Arling, it's been fantastic speaking with you. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Tusen takk.
We'll be hearing all about movement and dance in just a moment. So here's a track to get you in the mood. This is new from London artist Georgia. It's About Work, The Dance Floor.
That was About Work, The Dance Floor by Georgia. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
The English National Ballet is currently performing a season of three shows at London's Sadler's Wells Theatre as part of their She Persisted series, works about and created by women.
The performances range from Broken Wings, celebrating the life of artist Frida Kahlo, to Nora, based on the works of Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen, and a new production of influential German choreographer Pina Bausch's Le Sacre du Printemps, which means the rites of spring.
Tamara Rojo is the English National Ballet's artistic director and recently came to Midori House to talk to Monocle's culture editor Chiara Ramella about the project. Chiara began by asking about the discipline involved in ballet and whether it's more of an athletic or artistic pursuit.
It is a difficult balance, and I think it's one that we consistently question as well. Certainly it's one that I question as an artistic director. One of the things I tell my dancers is go out, see the world. If you have free time, don't be in the studio watching others practice what you've already practiced. Get out into the street, go to museums, go to the theater, watch movies. Get friends, have a social life outside of the ballet world. Because I want artists that have a mind of their own, that ask questions, that don't take things for granted just because they've been done before like that, even though they're more difficult to manage, if I'm honest. But I'd rather have that. I want to have intelligent artists.
Let's talk about then your role as artistic director of the ENB. What from your previous life did you bring into it, both from your life as a dancer and also what kind of influences do you think shape most the vision that you have for the programming?
One thing that I've always loved is history, and especially history of ballet and history of dance. So by the time I became artistic director, I had a clear idea of the place of this company in the history of dance in the United Kingdom and in the history of ballet as a whole. And I think that's what gave me a certain assurance of what I believed the role of English National Ballet was, which is, in my opinion, a visionary company from the beginning. I mean, it was created to bring the greatest ballet to the widest possible audience, wherever they are, whatever their means. And that, at that time, is revolutionary because everybody else was trying to make a ballet company that was exclusive, that had a royal title, that belonged to an opera house. And then you have these two people, Markova and Dolin, who came from the Ballet Russe, which was a company that was a touring company, that said, no, no, our duty is to bring this wonderful art form to everybody in the United Kingdom. Our duty is to go out there, not to sit in one theatre, but to go and find the audience, to bring them the best and to make them possible to see it and to enjoy it, no matter what their financial position may be. And that is what this company continues to be and what feeds my artistic vision and why I wanted to take this role. Because I had been part of this company as a young dancer. I had seen what it means to bring this to people that otherwise might not see it again for a whole year. So I had this sense of duty towards the company. obviously the question is, what is the most wonderful ballet? You know, that is where we can have a lot of conversation about what I think is best or other people think is best. And there I also feel quite a lot of inspiration from great people. I mean, for me, the figure of Nureyev is very inspiring, and not just as a dancer, because as a woman, maybe not so much as a dancer, but as an artistic director. He was groundbreaking in how he saw the classical repertoire, but also in the fact that he invited people that no other ballet company considered ought to be part of the ballet curriculum. And in a way, that's what I do. I think in that perspective, I do have a sense of duty to Britain in the kind of choreographers I bring, that they have to represent the whole of the cultural of Britain, you know, whether it's Akram Khan or Russell Malifan or Liam Scarlett or female choreographers, female voices on the stage. I just want to be a company that speaks to the people of today.
It's interesting. You have very, very important and interesting programming coming up, including, for example, a whole set choreographed by Pina Bausch, and you're going to be doing A Doll's House. How did this whole come about, and how far can you take pushing the programming as well before you go a little bit too far and you get pushed back?
So the program we're about to present at Saldus Wells is She Persisted. And the reason why this came about is because in 20 years of career, I had actually never performed on stage a piece created by a woman. No one have ever commissioned a woman in all of the years that I had been in EMB and the Royal Ballet. So for me, it just didn't seem right. So I decided that I needed to use this position to give opportunities to female choreographers, which I know existed, but they were not being seen. And so we created She Said 3 years ago. And that was a program of three female choreographers. And the interesting thing is that it started a conversation around the ballet world. And suddenly companies had to react and they started commissioning women. And so it was, I think it was a good starting of the conversation, but I didn't want it to end there. I didn't want it to say, oh, that's it, I've done this, so now I can't forget about it. So we continue to commission women throughout all of the activities. So we presented, in the last 6 years, we presented 28 works by women in English National Ballet. But I thought it was time to do the next step and also to commission someone from within the company. And we had this beautiful dancer, Stina Quajover. She created the role of Mirta in Akram's Khan Giselle. I had seen some of the work she had done for choreographic workshops. And so I started to send her to other choreographic opportunities outside EMB so she could continue to develop. And I felt that this was the moment where she could create her new piece. And it was her idea to do it about A Doll's House. It was something that she had in her mind that she really wanted to do. So in a way, my job there was just to make sure that she had the right support around her. Because obviously a first commission is always a scary for a young choreographer, so that she could have a good music and a good music director and, you know, all the support around her to make sure that she feels safe, as well as being within the company that she belongs to, which already means everybody's on her side and we all want her to succeed. And so another piece that we're presenting is Pina Bausch, Rite of Spring. For me, this version of Rite of Spring is extraordinary. And the figure of Pina Bausch is one of those figures that also inspires me as an artistic director in how much risk she was taking. And so I wanted to present it. It's not easy. We're only the second company in history to present this work. But I have to say it's been a pleasure to work with the company, with Pina Bausch Foundation and everybody, and really inspiring for the dancers of English National Ballet. And the last piece is by Anabel López Ochoa. And she wanted to create a piece about Frida Kahlo, a very, very strong, determined woman. So I thought it was the right program to put forward and the right next step in trying to create this platform for female voices.
We hardly ever think about the women behind the scenes in ballet. You know, it's a strange world because on the one hand, you have the prima ballerina that's always in the spotlight, but sometimes the person who's not exposed isn't necessarily the most powerful. Do you feel that in ballet also this balance needs to be redressed? And how can we redress it?
I think what's interesting is that we seem to have forgotten our own history. Because the truth is, the big companies in this country, whether that is Royal Ballet, English National Ballet, Rambert, Birmingham Royal Ballet, they all came about because of women. You know, it was Ninette de Valois, Mary Rambert, and Alicia Markova who created these companies. They were directors. They were leading from the front. At the time, there was also choreographer Nijinska, Bronislava Nijinska, and her works were represented on the stage. So in both Rambert and Royal Ballet, for example, and actually London Festival Ballet. So in a way, somehow, we, the ballet world, forgot our own history. I don't know how that happened, but it did. So it's not that I'm being that revolutionary. I'm just readdressing the balance here and just saying, you know, all voices ought to be on the stage. Women, men, and different cultural backgrounds and contemporary visions. And I do think that it has been something that people have responded to and that now you can see all across the ballet world commissions for women. If anything, there's now a lack of enough women ready for all the commissioning. So I think that's a good thing.
So obviously the English National Ballet has been touring for all this time, but I understand you're getting your own HQ at the moment. Mm-hmm. How do you think that's going to change the way that you do things? Is it going to change the way that you do things?
It will change the way that we prepare for touring, because for the first time we're finally going to have a proper home with enough studios for the company and the school to work together, so to give the students in the school already an inspiration and a clear expectation of what a professional dancer is and a closer relationship. Also, we will have an amazing facility. We'll have a stage with all of the rig to be able to rehearse every production with lighting, with costumes before we take it on the road, something that doesn't exist at the moment in the UK. Most people that want to rehearse a production, whether that is a musical, an opera or a ballet, have to close a theatre, and that's obviously very costly. So what I'm hoping is not only we will use it, but other people of the industry will use it. So our home will become a hub of artistic creativity. My dancers will be able to rap shoulders in the canteen with Florence and the Machine, or they will be able to see the next Macintosh musical being created, or an opera, or whatever. And they'll be able to see all of this and feed from all of these ways of creating art. But intrinsically, we will continue to be a touring company because it is not a theater. What we're having is a home that I felt our dancers deserved because they work hard. And at the moment, we don't have the proper gym or the proper rehabilitation facilities or the proper studios or a dressing room where you can sit and put your makeup on. And I felt that they deserved it.
Tamara Rojo there speaking to Monocle's Chiara Remella. And the She Persisted series of shows runs until the 13th of April at Sadler's Wells Theatre here in London. And do listen out too for an extended interview with Tamara later this month as part of the new season of Monocle 24's The Big Interview. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, Tom Edwards and Augustin Macellari in the chairs. We were hearing and talking about ballet org before. Let's stay with ballet now, but a different incarnation.
Pauline Ballet, who's a French photographer whose images of cycling have come to help define the sport in recent years. Next week, she'll be focusing her lens on the infamous Paris-Roubaix race. First held in 1896, the grueling one-day event has also been dubbed the Hell of the North, with riders tackling long stretches of treacherous cobblestone roads along the route, which runs just north of Paris, up to France's border with Belgium.
But it's more than just a classic one-day race. The events become important to the local region all year round. And in the most recent edition of Cycling Bible Rouleur magazine, which is brilliant, by the way, the title's been exploring the significance both in and out of the saddle of the event.
Monocle's Daniel Bache recently spoke to Rouleur editor Andy McGrath and photographer Pauline Ballet to learn more.
I suppose I should start by explaining what Paris-Roubaix is, because most people on the street might be aware of bike races like the Tour de France, maybe the Tour of Italy and the World Championships. It's an exceptional race for so many reasons in so many ways, perhaps principally because of the 55 kilometres of cobblestones that are included in the race. And there's nothing like it in the sport of cycling. We love Paris-Roubaix. It's probably my favourite race, even more so than the Tour de France, just because the Tour's a bit like a test cricket match. you have some really great days and you have the okay, fine, and even not so great days. But you need the rough with the smooth to really get that three-week narrative and get that enjoyment. Whereas Paris-Roubaix is all action. I think it's the only bike race of the year that I watch from start to finish, because the first few hours go so quickly when they're not on the cobblestones. And then when they are, you just don't want to look away. It's so exciting because so much is happening. Riders are crashing, there's punctures, there's either dust flying if it's dry, or mud everywhere if it's wet. And a wet Paris-Roubaix is, for the cycling fan, it's a hallowed thing and slightly sadistic thing. But anyway, why we did it. We saw an opportunity to really express our passion for the race with something that hadn't been done before. But there's so many interesting nuggets on the route, you know, from the start in Compiègne, which passes, I think, the train carriage where the armistice was signed in World War One, to all these quirky things you pass on sectors, like there's Maginot Line forts in one field, and I think pink blossom trees in Saint-Quentin. Ostensibly, we were just looking for the best possible shots on race day, but you actually get so much more. You get a real impression of the Nord, which is the French département where all the cobblestone sectors are. And you're passing through all these red brick houses, many of which are old mining towns. Because, and this is quite important, this area of France, it had the richest mining seam in the country. I was looking over my research earlier, and I think post-World War II, France had 300,000 miners. Well, within 40 years, they were all gone. All the mines were closed, and that especially hit this region very hard. But Paris-Roubaix has always had a close link to the mining community as well. There's even been people who were miners who became cyclists who competed in Paris-Roubaix. Sometimes the miners would even be watching on that Sunday when the race passes. And the hardest sector, one of the hardest sectors of Paris-Roubaix, the Arenberg, is iconic not just for its difficulty, but partly because it passes the old pit head of the Arenberg mine. So that's just another thing you get entangled in. Like, you can even go around the mine, the Arenberg mine. And we have, I think me and Pauline have done it twice, because they give tours. Former miners are giving tours free of charge. And it's fascinating, but it's also terrifying to hear some of the stories. It's just, you have someone like myself born in the 1980s. It's unimaginable what they had to face, you know, the darkness, the fear, because some people lost their lives in the mines too. And it's such a part of who they are, the Nordistes. And that still ties into cycling, that element of hard work, of kind of having grit and really knuckling down. Those are key characteristics if you want to win this iconic bike race.
Pauline, let's just bring you in here. I wanted to ask you about how you set out to actually capture this race, because you cover many, many bike races, and this being a one-day event, a race that is so important to the history of the area, but also to the sport. I wonder how you think about planning your day to capture a race like this and how you want to showcase it.
Paris-Roubaix has to be planned, of course, because there is when you're working, especially on motorbike, there is a lot of cobbles areas and a lot of section to cut if you want to pass on the peloton again. And so you have to know very well the area. So you have to plan that. That's why also last year when we went with Andy and Ruler all the week before the race, it was also days to plan for the race day. But what is very, frustrating and at the same time, part of the job is like, even if you plan everything, the race days can be totally something different. Like, you can plan everything, like every place you want to stop, every section you want to take for the cut, but you don't know why, because of a lot of cars who are blocking the route, or I don't know, some puncture, some crash or anything, everything can be changed and you have to just react in a second and just to change your plan. And sometimes you can have a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, but sometimes you don't have other ideas. So you just go back on the motorbike and you just try what you can, you know. So planning is something, but you have to be also ready to change everything in the second every time in the race. And it's something I like, because I just feel also sometimes like, I mean, not like riders, but it's something I like with Paris-Roubaix. It's for me like riders, I have to accept before the race that the worst and the best could happen on this race. And the most difficult for them, I think, is to accept that before crossing the start line. And I think for them, it's also an honor and a freedom to cross the finish line. And in a part of the thing, for me, it's the same thing when I start and when I finish the race.
If we look at this race and how it's been captured historically, the visuals of it are really agony. It's mud, it's pain, there's blood. It's a very visually stunning race, but there's also the culture and the people around it. So there's a bit of a mix of celebration. There's a little bit of everything. So, Pauline, as you say, there's not really a way that you can really plan it, but I wonder if there are shots that you know you really want to get or that you really need. Of course, there's the iconic shower stalls at the end, which is, you know, on the cover of the magazine, very famous cement stalls that we often see at the end of the race when we can see the pain that these riders have gone through. But are there specific shots that you know you are going to get no matter what?
Yes, exactly. Yes. You have the picture in your head. You know, you need them. You need them to tell the story, of course. For example, for me, the Wallers Arenberg is definitely a place I know I have to be front of the peloton at this moment. Whatever happened before, I need to be front of the peloton in order to find my spot and to have some picture in this cobble sector, which because it's maybe one of the most difficult, but also it's a most important in the history. And so there is so many things iconic about this cobble sector. I need picture there. It's the same about, of course, the velodrome. You need to be front of the peloton to enter in the velodrome. I think the only thing you cannot plan is crash, the puncture and all the things. If it happened in front of you, you're lucky in a way. And if it's not, I mean, there is a lot of stuff you cannot plan, but yeah, there is some picture you have to plan and you need to have.
And if we look at, again, you dedicating an entire issue to one race, I wonder what the bigger objective of that is, I guess, and what it can say about professional cycling and about even culture around it, fans. This is such a historically important sport in many regions of Europe and around the world. But if you're dedicating a magazine to one day, then what are you trying to tell in a bigger sense?
Well, I think this one day, firstly, it's kind of like Christmas Day for cycling fans. It's the thing they look forward to the most. So in a way, I suppose we're part of that anticipation process. That's one of the reasons that we did it. I suppose it is a risk editorially, but I don't see it as a risk, certainly not with the magazine in front of me now, completely finished. I think it's strange because pro cycling has had ups and downs over the years, but this is a race ingrained in its cultural fabric. You know, it's a sport that has branched out to races in Australia, Dubai, California, that are getting more and more prestigious, but its heartland remains France, Italy, Belgium, and Paris-Roubaix has been going for, well, it's into its third century now. I just find it so interesting that it is one of the biggest things in the sport, but it's so micro as well as being macro. Like, we sent Pauline to a little cafe called Chez Françoise in Trouville, which is the first cobbled sector. Completely nondescript town, completely average-looking cafe. But every Tuesday of Paris-Roubaix week, the organisers, when they drive from Paris, they stop there to have breakfast, and it's their big custom. It's been going on for 25 years. And Françoise, who still owns it, has done for 30 years, she makes some omelettes. And it's just this mix of kind of humility and simplicity with what is such a big event now. It is really waited for. There's a lot of money behind it. In so many other sports, you'd think it might get lost, like the kind of the basic values, the interest could get lost. But somehow they're balancing it. So it treads that. That's very interesting, I think, in modern sport. And modern culture, even. If people haven't seen Paris-Roubaix, I'd recommend turning on your TV on Sunday, maybe around lunchtime, and catch a bit of it. It's like nothing you've ever seen before. It's a kind of addictive madness for riders, for fans, photographers, for everyone.
Pauline, if we look at how you plan to tell the story this year of Paris-Roubaix, after you took time to dig into the culture and the history of the race, a little bit more so this year working on this edition of the magazine, I wonder if that changes your approach to capturing the race this year, or if you're just trying to get the best pictures you can, as you usually are?
I think it's both of them. I think it's definitely both of them. I always trying to think of how to tell the story, especially with this race, because for me, this race represents, for me, the purest sense about cycling. Like, there is the proximity with public. There is all same ritual thing, as we said before, with Chez Françoise before the race. So, of course, I'm trying to do in the moment the best shot I can do. But there is always the story in my head I never forget about that race. So I try to mix between them. I mean, I just try to find a good position also to show the sport things in the context always. So it's my way of photographing. Especially this race.
It's such a difficult race for the teams in a logistics sense. So, and sort of the teams really rely on fans and supporters in a certain sense. Isn't that right, Andy? This is really a community vibe around this race.
It's crazy, yeah. I mean, it's perhaps the only race of the year where there's so much tension. You can feel it in the teams before the race. There's nerves. They want everything to go right. But as Pauline says, you can't plan it. So it's sometimes it's a bit of a lottery. But they'll employ everyone they can to stand on these cobbled sectors, put them in one of their team jerseys and have them holding up a wheel just in case if one of their riders has a puncture or a problem, they can maybe help and get them back in the race 30 seconds quicker or 10 seconds quicker. It's that important. That does not happen on any other race. That's unusual too. I've wanted to add as well is that sometimes it helps to understand Paris-Roubaix when you're in the region, not on the week of race day, which is something that Pauline and I did a few years ago. And it was a horrible January day. And you realise these cobblestones that are populated by so many spectators, they're just farm roads in the middle of nowhere. Like, there was no one there. Like, the wind's whipping across this completely flat rural terrain. Like, all the Nord is really to me is green fields, pylons, old slag heaps, and that Arenberg pithead. That's the mental image. And certainly, we actually ran a feature in the issue before this from the Grand Prix de Denain. And Denain was one of the main mining communities in the Nord before the mine closed. And we talked to some of the people there. And there was a feeling of disenfranchisement that we had a quote from a man on the day of the race, a spectator saying that they feel like they're nobodies, they're voiceless in Macron's France. So there is that background away from this one day party. It's a celebration of the Nord. They're very proud of this race. But the wider context is that you have this race going from Paris, which is the city of light, to Roubaix, which is one of the poorest in France. It used to be a massive textile centre, but it's struggling more. I think it's had a few. There was an incident with a terrorist cell there a few years ago. So you have that stark contrast as well, culturally.
Andy McGrath, editor of Rouleur magazine, and photographer Pauline Ballet there speaking to Monocle's Daniel Bache. And the Paris-Roubaix race takes place next Sunday, the 14th of April. Org, get your padded shorts on in good time.
You might need two pairs.
This is the Monocle Weekly. Well, Org, what a show that was. From the rattling on the cobbles to the view of the world from the top of Mount Everest. It's not every day you can speak to somebody who can give you, quite literally, that extraordinary perspective.
I know, it's a mad take. And I feel like we've come a long way today. I will be thinking more actively about how I walk, where I walk, why I walk, and when I choose to walk from this moment on.
Wow, that's almost philosophical. Well done.
I feel like, yeah. In fact, completely try.
Nevertheless, that is your 509th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Cheers to it. The programme was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Teresa Marvulli. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. My thanks to them all. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Augusta Macellari.